From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, we all know women are underrepresented in politics.
11,813 men and 294 women have served in Congress.
But the reasons for the disparity might surprise you. Also, lots of stories about immigrants are in the news. In one magazine, The Immigrants write back.
Immigrant stories are not just about a crisis situation.
And putting artificial intelligence to work to make NBA games more fun.
We started the company building software that allowed a computer to understand the game of basketball.
Plus, Betty White's big break, a possible fragment of Amelia Earhart's plane, and music to celebrate a new Eurekan identity. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West.
Mary says it's okay. She can see the future. Everything turns around. Everything turns around. Terrors may be coming. They are only games. Everything turns around. Everything turns around.
Take one look at Congress, and it's obvious women are underrepresented. The reasons why, not so obvious, according to Nancy Cohen, who breaks down the research in a piece for the magazine Pacific Standard. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be here.
So there's a lot of conventional wisdom about why there aren't more women in politics, and you looked at five studies that took on those ideas. I want to rattle through the first three kind of lightning round version. I'll set them up and you knock them down. First one, voter bias. Sexist attitudes mean that voters want to vote for men.
Not true.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any evidence that there's a double standard. The double standard is dead as far as politics is concerned. Voters, in aggregate, support women candidates at the same level that they support men candidates. Women win as often as men do in similarly situated elections. It's not to say that everyday sexism in the media doesn't exist or mm-hmm. that candidates aren't going to try to attack women candidates mm-hmm. with sexist ads, but voters don't buy it and voters don't let it influence their votes.
So you mentioned the media. That brings us to number two, which is the media reinforced gender stereotypes, and that's a big part of the problem.
It's really easy to pick out lots of anecdotes about media sexism. Those are certainly true. But if you compare the way the media treats men and treats women, there's no evidence that they're really treated differently. And in fact, voters do look at candidates with their own stereotypes. So those stereotypes they apply are partisan stereotypes.
It's looking like, obviously, there's momentum building around another Hillary Clinton run for president. When Hillary last ran for president, she said that there really was a double standard. But do you think that things have changed dramatically since then?
I think Hillary was right, and also that things have changed. But the fact that the media treated her in very sexist ways, mm-hmm. and there were these really awful kind of attacks on mm-hmm. her, you know, the nutcracker and the cackle and all that nonsense. Voters see through that. And I think maybe the media will be thinking a little bit more carefully about how they portray women candidates now that women are so active on social media in calling out retrograde nonsense.
Okay, so what about family? Women are too busy raising families to run for office.
Not true. Women have been managing the double shift for decades now, and particularly younger women expect that this is the fate that they face in American society. So being a mother doesn't stop women from running for office.
Okay, well, let's dig into the last two points. The first one is that women aren't running for office because they don't want to. There's a lack of political ambition in general among women for whatever reason.
The evidence is, as women, and particularly teenage girls, start seeing more women in office, they get a jolt of political ambition. So the solution is for more women to run so that more teenage girls have the desire to run when they're adults.
And what about the final argument that you take on, that the way that this political system is structured is kind of rigged against women?
The United States has a winner-take-all system. What that means is that incumbents are very powerful. So looking at U.S. history as a whole, 11,813 men have served in Congress, and 294 women have served in Congress. So there are a lot of people that argue that if we tinker with the way we hold elections, then we might be able to get more women in office.
Nancy Cohen is a writer and historian. Nancy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's less than 2 minutes long, but a video titled 10 Hours of Walking in New York City as a Woman has been viewed more than 27 million times.
Damn! Damn!
Hey, beautiful!
The hidden camera video shows a woman walking through New York as men make more than 100 unwanted, sometimes sexual comments to her. The video is a PSA for the anti-street harassment nonprofit Hollaback. Earlier this week, I spoke with a young woman at the center of the video, actress Shoshana B. Roberts. Roberts says she deals with street harassment every day. So when she saw a Craigslist ad looking for a woman to take part in the video, she jumped at the chance.
I was so fed up. I saw these keywords, raising awareness, street harassment. We have to do something about it. And I felt the need to step in, and I can do this. I have acting training. I have martial arts experience since I was 9. Should I go for the kneecaps or the sternum if anybody tries anything beyond? Because it escalates so quickly. It does.
Have there been situations in the past where you've had to use your training?
Fortunately, not. But there have been times that I should have. I've had experiences of sexual assault in my past. Starting in middle school, unfortunately, I have firsthand experience with sexual assault.
At one point in the video, a man walks silently next to Roberts for more than 5 minutes. It feels very menacing.
Yes, I was extremely scared.
Did you feel in danger?
I felt on edge. I felt cautious. I felt like it could easily go in that direction. But I was thinking, I'm doing this for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
I want to enlighten people. I want to let them know that this is happening to so many women from all types of people. I mean, I was walking around Midtown and Harlem and South Ferry and Washington Square Park. And I'm getting these reactions from white, black, Latino, Asian, Indian. I mean, my story is not unique. So many women experience this.
You mentioned the diversity of the harassers, but I'm sure you've seen there's been some criticism online that this video is mainly showing African-American and Latino men as opposed to white men.
I mean, that was 2 minutes of footage, and I guess a video doesn't go viral unless it's short, depending on people's attention span. But we had hours and hours of footage that day. I can say this is my experience from that day and from life, that it doesn't matter what color, size, shape you are. I get harassed from everyone, no matter what I wear. It doesn't matter what you wear.
And you know, unfortunately, the internet being the internet, there's also been a lot of, you know, negativity and anger, and I understand threats also directed against you as well.
Yeah, I stopped reading. My inbox is so inundated with emails, I haven't been able to see a fraction of them. I do not feel safe right now. I mean, I didn't feel safe before, but clearly, I guess people are aware of the way I look and who I am now. I'm alerting the police as to which jurisdiction I'm in, so my local precinct knows, and prior to something happening, so hopefully it can be prevented if somebody does attempt something. Nobody's attempted anything, but there have been threats, and luckily I'm not even hearing them or reading them verbatim, but friends and family have informed me because I haven't been reading online.
Do you have any second thoughts, though, about having done the video? Would you do a video like this again?
I have not had second thoughts. I don't regret it.
Shoshana Roberts is an actress based in New York City. She's the subject of the now viral YouTube video, 10 Hours of Walking in New York City as a Woman. Shoshana, thanks very much for talking with us.
Of course. Thank you for listening.
Here's a story that breathes some new life into an old mystery. Amelia Earhart disappeared on the second-to-last leg of her attempt to fly around the world in 1937. Theories about what happened are as wide-ranging and hotly debated as the conspiracy theories around the Kennedy assassination. When you sweep aside the more far-fetched scenarios, that Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan were, say, captured by the Japanese or by space aliens, there are two leading theories of what happened to Earhart. The first is that they were killed when their plane, a Lockheed Electra, crashed into the ocean. Here's aviation researcher Rick Gillespie.
There have been multi-million dollar deep sea searches in the area where people think that that occurred. They haven't found anything, but that's still a prevalent and maybe the most prevalent theory about what happened to her.
Rick Gillespie is in fact an advocate for the other leading theory, that Earhart managed to land on a deserted island where she and Noonan initially survived before starving to death. In 1985, he established the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, or TIGER, to search for evidence to prove that theory. They think Earhart landed on a tiny island called Nikumaroro. TIGER has been there 10 times and collected what they believe is physical evidence that Earhart and Noonan lived briefly on the island, but nothing definitive. In a 1991 visit, they found a sheet of aluminum that appeared to come from an aircraft.
We thought it might be from Earhart's airplane, but we couldn't match it to any part of a Lockheed Electra. We went to museums and measured Electras. We looked at the engineering drawings. It was close, but no cigar.
Then, out of the blue this summer, 23 years after that aluminum patch was found, one of Gillespie's researchers remembered that right before that historic takeoff, an aluminum patch had been attached to Earhart's plane. The Miami Herald was able to dig up an archival photo.
And lo and behold, suddenly, it's okay, it's the right dimensions, it's the right proportions. That rivet pattern mentions the lines of rivets, very distinctive. Something we had never been able to match to anything else. Suddenly, we've got something that matches it.
Gillespie insists that the match is as specific as a fingerprint, but TIGER's findings, published online this week, have not been peer-reviewed or independently confirmed. Richard LaPook, an advocate of the water crash theory and vocal critic of Gillespie, told the Miami Herald this week that the piece of aluminum definitely could not have come from Earhart's plane. He says it was stamped with letters indicating it was made after the Electra was built. While we can't say who's right, there is money at stake here, as well as reputations. Gillespie is trying to raise funds for an expedition that he says will prove the plane came to rest in the ocean right off the island. He even knows exactly where he's going to look, thanks to a sonar image from 2012.
There's an object down there, which is in 600 feet of water at the base of a cliff underwater. It is about 37 feet long, and it's about 4 to 5 feet tall based on the sonar shadow we see. And we see, yeah, well, that's about right for the fuselage of a Lockheed Electra.
I asked him if he was thrilled after all these decades at the prospect of finally having real proof for his theory. He said, actually, he's terrified.
You know, I'm not looking forward to the time when we put a remote-operated vehicle down there and the camera is going to show whatever that thing is, because it's going to be yes or no.
That no would mean Earhart's disappearance remains as much of a mystery as ever. Thanks again for listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. And we're joined once again by Beto Arcos, world music DJ, L.A. man about town, intrepid traveler. He always brings us the most awesome music. And this time, all from Mexico, right, Beto?
That's right. I wanted to bring some attention to the wealth and the breadth of Mexican music across the country, because there are areas that, unfortunately, we hear about some bad news of what's happening in Mexico, but sometimes people don't see the good side. And I wanted to bring attention to some regions of Mexico through the music of these groups that we're going to feature today.
So before we learn about our first artist, let's listen to a little bit of his music.
Supongo que los días vendrán con sus revelaciones y quisiera ir con los ojos llenos de asombro no más. Adiós al miedo, estoy emocionado de andar con encendidas antenas al porvenir.
Beto, who is this guy?
His name is David Aguilar. He's from the northwestern state of Sinaloa. And he is, in my opinion, one of the most gifted, talented singer-songwriters right now in Mexico. He's maybe about 30 years old, but he knows how to craft, how to create a beautiful song and a melody. I just think he's one of the great artists right now happening.
El diente más honesto del engrane que me toca girar. Y entre paredes, con movimiento hallaré señal. Ya es resistencia vivir. Porque parece que además no quedan muchas alternativas. Y está la cruel sensación.
So beautiful and bright. What's he singing about?
This is a song that's called Antenas al Porvenir, which means something like an antenna to the future, meaning the world may be falling apart. We feel like sometimes there are all this bad news going on in Mexico, in the Middle East, in Africa, but we have to be positive. And he's basically saying, look, there's a bright future coming up. It's going to be good.
And talking about trouble, he's in a place, he's in Sinaloa, that's associated with a lot of violence.
That's right, that's right. And here is someone that, despite all of that, says, hey, we actually have something really exciting here.
Once again, that's the music of David Aguilar. The song is called Antenas al... Say it for me, Beto.
Antenas al Porvenir.
Beto, who's next?
The next band is this group from my hometown of Jalapa, Veracruz, in the Gulf Coast of Mexico, the capital of the state of Veracruz, and they're called Los Aguas Aguas.
Pretty funky stuff there.
Yeah, this is a band that initially started playing roots music, Son Jarocho from Veracruz. And pretty soon, within a couple of years, they started blending in funk and especially reggae music.
Yeah.
And so what you hear really is this kind of beautiful mix, this kind of confluence of musics. In particular, this song that's called El Sol, or The Sun, talks about this environment that they've been living in Jalapa, in Veracruz, a place that's been unfortunately also plagued by violence. But the singer is basically saying, there's all this stuff going on, but let's be positive and let's confront this and say we have to keep on living.
En la noche me despierta un sonido de balazos. En las calles se pelean. Piedras contra bazucazos, el ejército llegó. ¡Ya llegó! Empuñando la granada.
This is a band that is very, very much representative of what's happening in the music in Veracruz, that maybe started playing just kind of party songs, but now they're saying, we have to say something about what's happening.
Again, that's music from Las Aguas Aguas. The song is called El Sol. My guest is Beto Arcos, world music DJ with KPFK here in Los Angeles. Beto, more.
Let's take a listen to this new recording by one of my all-time favorite bands. It's called Pasatono Orquesta, and their new record is called Maroma. And let's listen to this kind of overture into the world of the maroma or circus.
Beto, before we started, we were talking about Fellini, and I hear what you're talking about here. This is kind of a Fellini circus, isn't it?
It is. You know, in Oaxaca, there's been a tradition for a couple of centuries now of this sort of traveling circus that goes from village to village. And so what Pasatono Orquesta is doing is kind of recreating that period through music. And so you hear this kind of blend of sort of Eastern European flavors, sometimes a little like klezmer sounding,
yeah,
with Mexican music. It's this kind of coming together, this kind of river of sounds and textures.
Dicen que arriba del cerro hay un mundo.
Tell me more about this circus celebration. This isn't animals and Barnum and Bailey kind of stuff.
I'm glad you asked. You know, the Maroma tradition in Mexico, the village circus in Mexico, is all about acrobatics. Nothing to do with animals. They set up in small towns, sometimes outside of the town, in the evening. And so people come and see these acrobats at night. Full moon outside, a band playing, and you are just, in a sense, almost in a kind of a movie scene.
Again, the music is by Pasatono Orchestra. Beto, you always leave us with something fabulous. So what do you got here?
Well, this is also one super band. They're from Guadalajara, Jalisco. They are Troque, and they play this fantastic, really cool mix of funk and hip-hop and jazz, and they absolutely just burn on stage.
Wild music, and we talked about how Las Aguas Aguas shifted gears all the time. These guys are crazy that way.
Absolutely. This is a tune that if you listen closely to, especially the trumpet riffs, you'll hear a little bit of the hint of mariachi music. Now, Guadalajara, as many people might know, is the capital of mariachi music. It's the capital of tequila. That's where tequila comes from. So there is a little hint of the sort of mariachi sound, but ever so slightly, because they don't want to be associated with the mariachi. They are nothing to do with mariachi. They're troquer, and I've seen these guys on stage. They are something else.
The band is Troquer. Great, great stuff there. The album is called Crimen Sonoro. Go to nprmusic.org to take a longer listen to all of these selections. It's all thanks to Beto Arcos. He's the host of KPFK's Global Village here in Los Angeles. Beto, you did it again. Thank you so much. This was a blast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When Pamela Ancheng came to the United States from Cameroon 20 years ago, she had a problem. Like a lot of immigrants, she felt that she didn't see herself in the media.
I just felt like there was a void. Yes, there are tons and tons of magazines out there, but most of these magazines and newspapers target themselves. So say you read India West or Africa Times. What are the chances that someone non-African or non-Indian would pick that up? So essentially, you're preaching to your own choir.
10 years ago, she started The Immigrant Magazine to provide a bridge to those different communities with stories from a wide range of perspectives.
Immigrant stories are not just about a crisis situation. Immigrants don't always want to see themselves as victims.
Right now on the site, there's a story about palliative care in the Chinese-American community, a Korean TV show that tackles mental illness, and a new album from a Ghanaian musician. Pamela Ancheng's own immigrant story started in 1994 when she left Cameroon, after a spring of multi-party politics took off in the country. Her cousin was one of the opposition leaders who challenged the president, and her family felt unsafe.
We were politically targeted. Socially, I felt, in the university, harassed. So I left Cameroon under those conditions, you know, thinking, you know what, let me go to a place where I can be myself, where I can thrive.
When she came to the U.S., she started working as a teacher and a computer engineer. But Ancheng dreamed of being a journalist as a child, so she started writing articles about Africa and her life back home.
But turns out, I had no place to publish them. There was nowhere to share my experiences.
Living in Los Angeles, she met immigrants from all over the world and started hearing remarkable stories. She found out that she wasn't the only one who didn't feel she had a voice.
And so I decided, I said, you know what? If we don't have a place to tell our stories, I'm going to create mine.
She founded The Immigrant Magazine as a print magazine in 2004. Now it's a website and online newsletter. One of the stories that's meant the most to her over the years was an interview with a Filipina immigrant.
Virgilia Villegas is her name. And I was doing this interview with her. And in the middle of the story, she said, Pam, I came to the United States because my mother paired me up with her business partner. I was only 16. And I moved out here, married to this guy. I had two children. And a few years later, I became a widow. She told me, I only have a high school diploma. And so she turns around now, and she's giving back. She has built a compelling enterprise of cultural pageants. Now, she doesn't call them beauty pageants because she's really about forming young women in the Latino community and the Asian community.
Stories like this about success and triumph are the ones that Ang Chang wants to get out to uplift immigrants in their communities. Most of the contributors to the magazine are freelancers, and she's not able to pay them yet, but hopes to in the future. Money for the magazine comes from advertising and sponsorship. She has a lot of goals for keeping this going and growing. They're adding video components and working to produce pilot shows that can be sold or syndicated. Though the site is mostly features and Q&As and isn't overtly political in nature, immigration is, of course, a heated political issue. I asked Pamela Ang Chang if, as the editor of a magazine like hers, it's hard to cover a community without also becoming an advocate.
You know, as I'm editing articles, I get all kinds of articles, and I try to be as, you know, fair as possible. I like to present both sides. However, my side is a humanitarian stance. So my political stance is purely advocacy. I also work with organizations who actually are grooming immigrants for leadership so they can, you know, run for office. So that maybe the more of us are in office, we can begin to maybe really then pass that message across. Because if we don't have any representation, politically speaking, how are we going to change any laws or make the laws to adapt to our interest? So, yes, I do have interest in the political. Yes, I do. It takes politics to make changes. So that's something that I do not neglect.
That's Pamela Ang Chang, the editor and founder of The Immigrant Magazine. When the Chinese writer Ha Jin came to the USA in 1985, he was just looking for a graduate degree before heading home to teach English. But a series of events shocked him into staying permanently, starting with the capture and trial of a Chinese spy named Larry Chin. Chin spent decades infiltrating the CIA, but at his trial, he insisted he was working to improve relations between the two countries.
He claimed that he was basically serving both countries. He used the metaphor mother and father. The man was somehow really, he was torn by the two countries.
In the 30 years since, Ha Jin's novels and stories have won him international acclaim and a National Book Award. His newest novel, A Map of Betrayal, follows the life of a spy who, with clear echoes of Larry Chin, is deeply ambivalent about spying on America, which he loves as much as China. I talked with Ha Jin this week, and I asked him if, like his character, he also felt torn between his two countries.
I do feel that I lived here long enough. I am American, but emotionally I could feel the division. Yes, because I lived in China for 29 years before I came to the States. That was part of myself, my past. I can't just erase it. So I could feel the pain, the suffering of the man. But again, my profession was different. You know, I'm a writer, I'm a teacher, so really had nothing to do with that kind of politics.
Can you talk about how you first came to America in 1985 and why you didn't go back?
I was a graduate student to study American literature. So my purpose was very clear. I would finish my dissertation, then I would go back to China to teach American literature. When I was finishing my graduate work, the Tiananmen suppression took place.
The Tiananmen Square uprising in 1989.
Yes. And that was a big shock, huge shock to me. And in fact, I was traumatized by it because I had served in the People's Army in China. We were instructed that our purpose was to serve the people, to protect people. But now everything was turned around. The field armies were sent into the city basically to kill and suppress civilians. So I just couldn't accept that. I just couldn't take it. That was a turning point. But it took a year or so for me to decide to write English and to live another life in the States.
I'm curious about the Tiananmen massacre being a turning point for you, because you say that you were in the Red Army in the 1970s. and that was during the Cultural Revolution when there was so much violence and repression. And wouldn't have you expected that kind of thing almost, having seen the darker side of the revolution close up?
No, because during the Cultural Revolution, most of the violent acts were committed by the masses, not really by the military.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the army. I stayed on the Sino-Soviet border. Our purpose was very clear, to defend the country, to protect the people. That's why the army was called the People's Army. And then I saw the tanks, the helicopters, you know, all kind of forces were rushed to Tiananmen Square. For me, I just couldn't take it. A part of my mind, the psychology collapsed, I would say, really, really collapsed. So for about 2 or 3 weeks, I lived in a trance. I just couldn't function. And later, gradually, I couldn't serve a government like that. I just couldn't.
And you have not been back to China since you left?
I haven't. That was, almost 30 years. I have not been able to go back. In fact, my mother died last October. I couldn't get a visa.
The authorities refuse you a visa for entry?
True. And I think there was a petition for democratic changes. Very mild document, but I signed that. I think I was told that was the reason that I couldn't get a visa.
Are your works read in China?
4 of my books have been translated, published in mainland China. But all the other books were published only in Taiwan. So people in the diaspora could read my Chinese translations. But in mainland, in recent years, it was very hard to get them published, especially since last year.
And you've written in some of these earlier books about parts of Chinese history which are certainly uncomfortable for the authorities.
True, true. But on the other hand, I didn't invent historically a lot of details. They are factual.
I wonder, with this book being, the politics in it are more subtle and it deals a lot more with America than with China. I wonder if this might be more palatable to the authorities, if there's a greater chance of this getting published over there.
Oh, this one is after the question, impossible, mm-hmm. because in the book, there's the larger theme, that is the individual and the country. Basically, the protagonist is betrayed by the country. So in that sense, politically, it is much more resonant than most of my other works. I don't think this book will see print in China if the current government stays in place.
That's Ha Jin. His new novel is called A Map of Betrayal. It's out on Tuesday. Ha Jin, thank you.
Thank you, Arun.
Dmitri Shostakovich, without doubt one of the greatest composers of the 20th century. He is, in a way, a perfect emblem for the suffering of the Russian people at the hands of two of the 20th century's greatest monsters, Hitler and Stalin. As a composer in Soviet Russia, Shostakovich lived in fear. Praised by the authorities one moment, denounced the next. He never knew when the capriciousness of Stalin might result in his arrest or execution. It had happened to his friends and relatives.
He could have been taken at any stage. He became withdrawn and, if not frightened, certainly justifiably nervous.
That's Brian Moynihan, author of the new book, Leningrad, Siege and Symphony. Right before Hitler invaded Russia, things were relatively calm there. Russia and Germany had in fact signed a non-aggression pact, and Shostakovich was teaching composition at the Leningrad Conservatory.
And then suddenly, in one day, one moment, at 3:50 in the morning of June the 22nd, 1941, everything changes and the Nazis invade. And Leningrad is more vulnerable and closer to them than most great Russian cities. So it's immediately in danger. And the Germans made huge gains in the early months of the war and were soon besieging Leningrad. And that is when Shostakovich begins to write this great symphony.
Could you give us just a sense of the human toll, the numbers of dead, because it's hard to comprehend.
It is the greatest disaster that has ever befallen any great city, and that includes Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all contenders. You had in the winter of 1941 to 1942, when Shostakovich is writing this symphony, although he's been evacuated, something of the order of 1.2 million people died, and the vast majority of them either froze to death or starved to death. They were eating, I mean, they very promptly ate every cat, rat, dog in the city. They were eating any sort of old leather there was around. Old handbags were being sold. So you had, I mean, on the absolute edge, a catastrophe.
Brian, in the midst of all of this suffering, violence, and deprivation, music is still very important in the city.
Music was extremely important. And it was soon realized that music fed the soul in a way that was extremely good for shattered morale. So a real effort was put into music in this dying city. But gradually all that winds down as fewer and fewer musicians are left alive to play, literally. And then the idea, when Shostakovich finally finishes his Seventh Symphony in February 1942, the idea is born that this great symphony must be played in Leningrad because he devotes it to the people of Leningrad. But the main orchestra, the Leningrad Philharmonic, had been evacuated before the siege began as the Germans were advancing, and all that was left was the radio comm orchestra. And to begin with, there weren't nearly enough musicians left to play it. They only had 20 because they'd lost something like 70 over the winter. So in order to achieve it, they withdrew soldiers who were in military bands and so forth from the front line, were brought back in. And Eliasberg, Carl Eliasberg, who is the conductor, managed to force them through rehearsals. But they were never fit enough to play it as a whole until the actual premiere.
And let's talk about that performance in Leningrad. First, it was in August of 1942, and there was some significance to that date.
There was a significance in that Hitler had claimed that Leningrad would fall in August 1942, and had indeed, people were saying he was going to go for a victory dinner at the Astoria Hotel, the very same place where this conductor, Eliasberg, and lead members of the orchestra were barely being kept alive. So the fact that there was still this resistance, still this pride, that Leningrad as a city had not been broken at the very time that Hitler said he would finally sweep through it, it's utterly moving.
And this performance, the annals of classical music are full of symphonic performances that are bizarre, but there is nothing I've read that's like this.
There's nothing, nothing, nothing. If you think of the 1812 Tchaikovsky, which people say, well, what about the 1812? And I say, well, what about the 1812? It was written 70 years after the event. This was written as the event is taking place, and played as this event, the greatest loss of life in one city ever recorded. It's played as that takes place. So it has that extraordinary impact. I can't think of another piece of music ever that has that.
That's Brian Moynihan. His new book is called Leningrad, Siege and Symphony, and it's out now. Brian, thanks very much.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about career triumphs, big and small. Betty White is a pioneer of television. From Life with Elizabeth back in the 1950s, to the Mary Tyler Moore Show, to her role as Rose in The Golden Girls. 60 years later, she's still in show business. Here she is in a clip from her TV Land show, Hot in Cleveland.
I got a spray tan.
You look very tropical.
Oh, no. I look like a f***ing Oompa Loompa.
Our producer, Daniel Hajek, caught up with Betty on the set of her show.
I was in the graduation play from high school, and the president of our senior class and I sang The Merry Widow and did a little dance. And, oh, I thought I think that's when the showbiz bug bit me. and they haven't been able to get rid of me since. My big break came when a local disc jockey, Al Jarvis in Los Angeles, invited me to be his girl Friday on his talk show, Hollywood on Television. So would I be his girl Friday? Sure, Friday, that's great. Well, what he meant, and I didn't realize, was Friday, Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week. Live. Whatever happened, you had to handle it. There was never any rehearsal or script or anything. Whoever came in that door was on, and you were interviewing them.
How old are you, Ralph? 10?
Is it all right if I call you Ralph?
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay? Will you call me Betty? What do you like to do, mostly?
Mm-hmm.
You have any favorite games you like to play?
Mm-mm.
The beauty of it is, if it didn't go well, it was over. People either sell their television sets or tune you in.
The second half of the Betty White Show from Hollywood.
Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. Every once in a while, they'll run something that we did years ago, and that's always fun. You think, my God, I had hair then, isn't it?
That's funny. I found a commercial you did back in the 50s.
You did?
Would you like to watch it?
Oh, I'd love to. Can we do that?
Oh, my. 1954.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Let's talk about you a little bit. How are you feeling? Do you get the feeling that you just don't have enough energy to finish out the day? That weak, run-down condition may be due to undernourished blood. Doctors have a special name for it.
Oh, my Lord, it was geritol.
But we call it...
Oh, that was 100 years ago.
Feel stronger fast. I wish you'd give geritol a try.
Oh.
This is the fast-acting, high-potency tonic.
My goodness, I hadn't even thought about that.
And it's good tasting, too.
To be able to talk to that camera, the camera became your best friend. You're looking into that little camera lens, and they're looking into your soul because they're right into your eyes. You can't be phony. You can't fake it because they'll pick up on it like that. I'm so lucky to still be blessed to be working in it. I love television.
Betty White, talking with our producer, Daniel Hajek. She's 92 years old and still in show business. Catch her in the new season of Hot in Cleveland, Wednesday on TV Land. You don't have to be a pioneer of television to have a big break. Send us your story, mybigbreak@npr.org.
Good evening, everyone. Opening night here in Los Angeles for the Clippers.
That's TNT's Kevin Harlan ushering in a new NBA season this past week. And for fans at that game at the Staples Center, they got some new toys. The Clippers were the first NBA team to roll out new features for the huge monitors that hover just above the playing floor. Here's one. Sometimes the video replay was enhanced to display all these intricate new statistics. Imagine what the game would look like from the Terminator's point of view.
So we have this product called Data Effects that combines storytelling, video, advanced stats, and special effects all together to tell sort of the hidden side of what is going on in the game that you might not see.
That's Rajiv Maheshwaran. I'll give you a proper introduction in a moment. There's also another app called the Clippertron,
which allows fans to take control of the Jumbotron in real time and ask for whatever video clip they want, a shot by Blake Griffin, a DeAndre Jordan dunk, and it would immediately go up there with your name on it.
Fans control the arena's highlight reel with their smartphones.
Paul. No! When you got a ladder, you got to climb it. And he did. DeAndre Jordan with an emphatic dunk.
So now back to Rajiv Maheshwaran. He's the CEO of a tech company called Second Spectrum, and they're dealing with the big data of sports. When former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer bought the Clippers for a cool $2 billion back in August, one of his first stops was Second Spectrum's modest two-room offices in downtown L.A.
And we had a bunch of projects that we had been working on the side that we thought would be really good for fans down the road, and we demonstrated that to him, and he said, this is great, let's do it now.
So, Rajiv, how much time did you guys have to pull this together?
6 weeks. But we were able to get a working version one out there today, but we're going to keep improving, and it's just going to get better and better with every game.
Maheshwaran shows me one of the models he'd originally shown to Steve Ballmer.
This is the biggest touch screen I think I've ever
yes.
seen.
It's an 82-inch. We use it a lot.
Oh, my kids would love this.
He pulls up a video that explains one of the most famous plays from last season's championship series, the Miami Heat's Ray Allen hitting a game-tying three-point shot with 5 seconds left in regulation. At key moments in the video, the play pauses, and the players each have little bubbles above their heads, like you'd see in a comic strip. But these bubbles have ever-changing numbers in them, percentages that indicate how likely they are to score from wherever they happen to be on the court. Ray Allen's teammate, Chris Bosh, jostles for position after a missed shot by LeBron James. Spatial relationships between player, ball, and basket are graphed and overlaid on the video. Bosh instinctively does what the numbers say he should do.
We know that Chris Bosh is not in position to get the rebound, but he moves himself into a better position. And we can talk about how that quantitatively. He gets the rebound, pops it out to Ray Allen, and then we can tell you really what likelihood he had of making that shot. Which he did. But there was all this underlying stuff that was going on before that shot that we can now sort of unearth with that moment.
The bread and butter of what Second Spectrum does is crunch a massive amount of data and help sports teams analyze it. Of course, the sports world has been using stats for years, but what can be done these days makes Moneyball look as simple as counting on your fingers.
In the newspapers, there were these things called box scores that have a certain amount of information, who took a shot, who took a rebound, who got a hit, who struck out. Now with player tracking data in almost every major sport, the amount of data is sort of three orders of magnitude more. I know where every single player and often the ball is 24 times a second, which is a lot of information. What are you supposed to do with that? Coaches don't want that. Front offices don't want that. They want meaning. They want insight. Turn these numbers into things that I care about. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do.
So how deep is the data? You have how many games all coded for the data? It seems...
So the National Basketball...
My head's spinning.
Yeah. So the NBA is also very forward-thinking. They have got tracking in every single stadium in the NBA starting last year. So starting last year, every single game in the NBA has been tracked.
So does that mean that they have motion sensors set up in addition to the video cameras? Or
so there's a company that installs 6 cameras in the roofs of all these stadiums and does some image processing. And about 3 to 4 hours after the game, they give you these files that tell you here's where every player was and every single second.
What's hard about teaching a computer to understand basketball?
So this is really the big challenge in understanding movement is that subtle variations can either mean nothing or a lot. Right? Like, if you don't know figure skating or ballroom dancing, as a human being, you could probably pick up on things very quickly. It's just very hard for a computer to come in with the knowledge that you have as a person to be able to recognize and separate patterns. Mm-hmm. And figuring out ways to train a computer to do that is the really hard part. There's a lot of ways to slice and dice and interact with data that we haven't started to explore yet. And This is just an example of what the future might look like.
That's Rajiv Maheshwaran. He's the CEO of Second Spectrum. They're bringing new technology to the NBA and beyond. If you watch Girls on HBO, you know Adam Driver. Adam plays Adam, the on-again, off-again boyfriend of Lena Dunham's character, Hannah.
You're the best thing in my life. I don't know how to behave without you. I'd die if you go away.
I don't want to be with you.
You do. We laid right there in that bed a month ago. And you told me if you ever broke up with me that I shouldn't let you.
Since it first appeared 2 years ago, Girls has taken off. And so has Adam Driver's career. He's been all over movie theaters this year. The cover of GQ in September, and he's going to be in the new Star Wars movie, out next year. Driver is 30 now, and relatively new to acting. His career was delayed by what might seem an unlikely diversion, the United States Marine Corps.
It was right after September 11th, and I wanted to be involved and serve. That coupled with the fact that I wasn't doing anything. I graduated high school and was just working a bunch of odd jobs to try and survive, you know, living in the back room of my parents' house. And I felt if I was going to join the military, then I'd join the toughest one. So that's why I joined the Marine Corps.
Driver was in the Marine Corps for 2 years. Then a mountain biking accident left him with a broken sternum. He was placed on limited duty and eventually medically discharged.
All my friends went overseas, and I kind of stayed in the rear with the gear, which really sucked. Plus, I just never got a chance to go over and do my job with the people that I had trained with from the very beginning.
You know, there's a common story for a lot of Marines. Tom Ricks wrote about this in his book, Making the Corps, about this doesn't have to do with combat, just the transition back to civilian life. They get kind of disillusioned from all the shallowness, the mundaneness of civilian life. And I'm wondering, having gone from the Marine Corps into the entertainment business, is that something that you felt?
Oh, completely. And plus in the Marine Corps, everything kind of has meaning associated to it. And you have a rank in the military that you've earned that suddenly, you know, you don't have in the civilian world. So, you know, don't you know who I am? Or, oh, no, you don't, because my rank isn't here. And nothing has meaning in this world. I think that's why, for me, theater was that thing. You know, I was lucky to get into school here in New York at Juilliard, and through kind of playwrights and characters and plays that had nothing to do with the military were describing my military experience in a way to me before was indescribable. And my problems are small compared to people who did go overseas and have a mental or physical injury.
So how did you get into Juilliard after getting out of the military?
I kind of had a moment of clarity when I was in the military. We had a training accident that happened early on where we almost got hit with white phosphorus, and that was the first time anything like that had happened to me. And I kind of made a conscious decision that two things I wanted to do before I died was smoke and become an actor. I don't know why those were the two things that kind of came into my head. Since stop smoking because it's not good for you. But I knew that Juilliard was supposed to be the best school. And I thought, you know, the Marine Corps is the best. Why not try for the hardest school possible to get in? I can't imagine doing that now. But then I thought civilian problems were pretty small. And so I just kind of auditioned.
Let's talk about the nonprofit that you started. It's called Arts in the Armed Forces. Tell me what it does.
Basically, my second year at Juilliard, I did notice a change in myself. Yeah, really being exposed to these playwrights who resonated with me. I kind of regretted not having that kind of exposure to theater or self-expression or just language when I was in the military. I wanted to share that with the military audience and reach out to different, you know, kind of veterans organizations. Or was like, is there a way to bring theater? And everyone, people were just kind of telling me that, you know, theater didn't fit the military demographic. They wanted to see the San Diego Chargers cheerleaders. And so I felt like, you know, as infantry Marines, we were capable of handling something a bit more thought-provoking. So I tried to create a project in my second year where we just took monologues, just diverse monologues that are diverse in age and race, like a military audience is, and keep it very pared down, no sets, no costumes, no lights, just actors just reading the material for a military audience. And they're not necessarily military themed. A lot of them aren't.
And you've got a special performance that you're putting on for Veterans Day. Can you talk about that?
We do. We've been doing one performance a year here in New York City. This November 10th, we're reading Our Lady of 121st Street by Stephen Edley Gurgis at Studio 54 as part of our annual fundraiser to go overseas at the end of the year, which is what we've been typically doing. Last year we went to Germany. This year we're going to Japan and Korea.
So
I'm sorry, but I got to ask you about Star Wars before I let you go.
Okay.
is there anything, can you talk about it at all?
I can't.
Can I ask you if you've been working on sword fighting skills?
I can't.
Let me ask you, I think I can ask you kind of a broad question, which you can probably answer. And that's that, you know, you've had this breakout success, you know, through Girls and other films. Girls kind of, it was its own thing. But Star Wars, you know, that's something that's this huge cultural product that carries a lot of weight. Do you feel that heavily as you go on the set and think, holy cow, I'm in Star Wars?
Yeah. All the time, especially at the beginning. You know, I'm weary of anything that big. I feel like I'm used to working on projects where, you know, we're doing a take and they're like, actually, can you keep that cigarette? Because we only have so many cigarettes to use in the scene. Where suddenly, like, it's so big that you feel like you'll get lost in it. But again, I think it was just back to story and character that, in a way, it's... You know, of course, it's completely different than Girls. It's a long time ago in a galaxy far away to start. But at the same time, if you think about, you know, breaking it down into moments and then just playing those moments and making them make sense as much as possible, it's actually not that far off from Girls in a way.
It's just kind of funny to think of the line coming out of this that Star Wars, it's kind of like Girls.
It's just like Girls. Everyone's naked.
That's Adam Driver, who is in This Is Where I Leave You in theaters right now. He's going to play somebody in Star Wars Episode 7 sometime next year. Adam Driver, it's been really fun speaking with you. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise.
This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth.
I definitely consider myself Puerto Rican, even though I wasn't born there.
Personally, my relationship with Puerto Rico has always been, I'm not from there, but I do consider myself Puerto Rican.
This is from a series of interviews with New Yorkans, New Yorkers of Puerto Rican descent. When you look over the long list of notable New Yorkans, everyone from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor to Jennifer Lopez, it's kind of amazing how much they've contributed to American culture. But what holds this diverse group together? Some born in Puerto Rico, some who have never set foot on the island, and everyone in between. How can a cultural identity be rooted in two different places? That's a subject that compelled saxophonist Miguel Senon to record these interviews and write a new suite of music to accompany them. It's called Identities Are Changeable.
I was actually born and raised in Puerto Rico. I moved to the States when I was 19. I was very impressed early on by you know, being around people who spoke my language and ate the same food and listened to the same music, dressed the same, but then you look around and, you know, you're not in Puerto Rico. You see high-rise buildings and everything is different. So even at that age, it was very interesting to me. People basically just, they were saying, you know, I'm Puerto Rican, even though a lot of them didn't speak Spanish very well or had only been to Puerto Rico like a handful of times, you know. It was really touching to me, and that whole idea had always been in my head, you know, how this idea of identity could be a lot more than just being born somewhere or speaking a language.
When I started just having multiple jobs where I'm the Puerto Rican, do you know how to speak Spanish? I go, you know, I can try to wing it. I got better just because I kept trying to talk to people.
What was the most surprising thing that you heard in these interviews?
Just how different their answers were. You know, I was expecting to find sort of like a general line of thought, a train of thought that would connect things for me, but it was very varied, you know, and pretty much everybody gave different answers to pretty much the same questions. And what that told me was that there is no right answer to this question. It has a lot to do with your own personal experiences. And a lot of the people that I talked to, especially the individuals who were older, they talked about, you know, going through different phases. And that really blew me away. It sort of changed my own definition of what all of this could be.
And in composing this piece with those voices, did you start out with an idea of the music that you worked the interviews into, or did the interviews kind of drive the music?
I worked on the interviews first. And then when I started writing the music, I was writing the music kind of having that in mind, that I was going to kind of insert this excerpt from the interviews, almost like thinking about it like a solo, like a feature.
I definitely feel like English is my first language now, more so than when I was younger, because when I was a child, I would speak more Spanish than I did English.
The Spanish thing, I think that kind of separates me from being a true, in a lot of people's eyes, Puerto Rican.
Can you give us an example of, you know, something that somebody said in one of the interviews, and how that drives the rhythm in one of these songs?
Well, sometimes I used it in different ways, like on a song called "True Culture and Tradition," when on one of the interviews, Camilo says,
"And through the music, I was able to understand my family and understand the language and understand the food and but music was a starting point, you know, understanding."
Bom Bom Plena, he's talking about this traditional music from Puerto Rico, and then I use that rhythm, Bom Bom Plena, that's the groove.
Going back to the title of this album, Identities are Changeable, you've been on the scene for a while now, your own style has changed, you've adapted, incorporated new things. How do you feel your musical identity has changed?
Well, the way I like to think about it is, even though I started music early, and I started music in Puerto Rico for a little while, I started in classical music, it wasn't until I discovered jazz music that I really fell in love with music, and I realized this is what I wanted to do, you know, for a living. And it was almost like learning a new language for me. It was like learning English. You know, you learn words here and there, and you learn a little more about the tradition, and you learn to put those words together, and eventually you learn how to express yourself in a natural way. But then I said, you know, so what about my music? What about Puerto Rican music and the music that I grew up with? I went back and checked out that music from that perspective and say, so this is what's happening harmonically, melodically, rhythmically. And I started getting more and more interested in that. Basically, the more I got into it, the more I realized that I knew very little about it. So most of the stuff that I've been doing for the past decade or so has had to do with me trying to learn more about Puerto Rican music and history and folklore and just culture in general, and trying to see how I can put that into what I do in an organic and honest way.
That's Miguel Sinon. His new album comes out on Tuesday. It's called Identities Are Changeable. And you can watch him perform this Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern at nprmusic.org. Miguel Sinon, thank you so much. Pleasure speaking with you.
My pleasure.
For the week ending November 2nd, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, Eliza Mills, and Suzanne Levy. Our intern is Chloe Prasinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Delagula and Marcia Caldwell. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.